I'm going to start this morning by looking at a couple of recent events. And one of them you'll be well aware of. But the second will be known to only a few of you. The first event I want to talk about occurred in late May when tennis legend Margaret Court penned an open letter to the West Australian newspaper criticising Qantas Airlines for its support of same-sex marriage and stating that she'd be using other airlines in future because of that support. As well as being a tennis legend, Margaret Court is also a high-profile Christian. She's the senior pastor at Perth's Victory Life Centre, a church that boasts 2,000-plus attenders. Shortly after the publication of her open letter, in an interview aired on Christian radio, Ms. Court voiced further opinions on same-sex marriage and the LGBTI community, which have been widely reported in the media. None of that's news to you. You've heard all about it. The other event I want to talk about happened a few weeks earlier, when a small group, less than half a dozen people from this church, along with others, answered a call to assist a local man who urgently needed to get his home ready for sale. Over a few hours, this group washed down walls, they sanded and painted, they pruned and weeded, they cleared rubbish, as well as sharing a coffee, some excellent slices and some conversation with the other volunteers there. The first of these events featured a celebrity sports person, a high-profile leader of a large church. The event made the headlines here and overseas, and it's in the news even now. The other event featured a group of people, a group of Christians, whose own personal moment of fame might have been no more than as part of a crowd photo in the Macedon Rangers leader as they wandered through the Gisborne market. It was an event that wasn't even a blip on the radar of most people in this region, let alone the world. Most of you wouldn't even know about it if it wasn't talking about it today. Not high-profile people. Not a high-profile event. But the question I'm going to ask today is, which of these two events has done the most to advance the kingdom of God? What do you think? To help in answering the question, we might need to take a closer look at the two events and also at their aftermath. In the case of the Margaret Court story, most of you already know the details and what's happened since. Ms. Court's been widely condemned from nearly every quarter, here and overseas. Other tennis legends have spoken out against her stance, with some even suggesting that we should rename the Margaret Court Arena here in Melbourne. In fact, in an apparent glitch, although it's hard to imagine how this could have happened accidentally, Google Maps actually temporarily renamed Margaret Court Arena to Yvonne Goolagong Arena. To put it mildly, public response to Ms. Court's open letter has been far less than positive. So to our other story, and this one needs a little more background. I'm really grateful to have been given permission to share this. In late April, Tamara, a member of our church, who most of you will know, posted in our closed Facebook group, The Buzz, seeking help for an urgent back and front yard and inside blitz to be held at a house in Gisborne over the coming weekend. There weren't too many details given, but I had the Sunday afternoon free, and it seemed to me that if Tamara said it was urgent, then it most likely was. So I went along, as did some others from this church. It turned out that the house belonged to a man by the name of Andrew, who needed to sell and needed to get the house in sale-ready condition as quickly as possible. It also turned out that Andrew is gay, as were several of the other helpers there. Now, I didn't know that at the time I decided to help, but it did become plain through conversation during the afternoon. I do know that it wouldn't have made a difference to my decision to help had I known that beforehand. And I'm sure that's also true of the others. It was just an afternoon of light labour, working as a team to help another human being with a need. After everyone had left, Andrew asked Tamara where she'd sourced the various helpers. She told him that some were through the support group that she founded, PS, My Family Matters, and that others were from her church. Now, as Tamara tells the story, Andrew was gobsmacked. He couldn't believe that people from a church, any church, would go out of their way to help him, a gay man. Andrew later posted this on Facebook. There was another working bee today, feeling supported to the point of overwhelm. There were people I knew and people I didn't. There were people from the Chargers, that's a gay rugby team, from a mental health support group, and from a non-traditional denomination Christian church. And everybody got on and did what they could. No questions, no judgments, just a generous offering of time, effort, care, and support. Diversity working together in a common cause. This is community. Indeed, the best of humanity. So I ask my question again. Which of these two events has done the most to advance the kingdom of God? Margaret Court's high-profile open letter, or our nondescript little team of handy men and women? No prizes for guessing what my answer would be. Now, it's not on my agenda today to critique Margaret Court's position on same-sex marriage. She has a right to her position, as do we all. I've read biblically based arguments that both support and oppose her position. And I also know that for many Christians, their position on the issue is along the lines of live and let live. Now, I don't know what your personal stance is on same-sex marriage, nor do I know what your personal attitude is towards the LGBTI community or LGBTI issues in general. But in a very real sense, what I do think is that to the world at large, your personal attitude on these issues doesn't matter a bit. To the world at large, your mouthpiece as a Christian is high-profile people like Margaret Court and high-profile groups like the Australian Christian Lobby, who grab the headlines where you and I can't. The world will form its view of what is surely your opinion based on what those individuals and groups say. Which then leads someone like Andrew to being gobsmacked that a group of Christians would help him out when he needed a hand. I think that's a little sad, don't you? Now I'm going to head off in what might seem like a new direction for a while, starting with a reading from the book of Acts, chapter 2, commencing at verse 42. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe at the many signs and wonders performed by the apostles. All the believers were together and had everything in common. They sold property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. Every day They continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favour of all the people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. The early church was small and pretty much devoid of influence. What they had was faith, joy, and above all, love. Love for God, love for each other, and love for their neighbours. They gave to anyone who had need. They were clearly visible in their joy and their generosity. They became popular and well-liked by the community, and their numbers grew daily. We also know about the persecution that the early church faced for more than two centuries, often savage persecution from the religious leaders of the day and from the Roman officials. And we know that despite the persecution, the church continued to grow. In the early 4th century, a Christian emperor, Constantine, came to power and enacted what is known as the Edict of Milan, which changed the official attitude of the empire towards Christians to one of benevolence. And then in 380 AD, under Emperor Theodosius I, Christianity became the official religion of the empire. From there on in, the sky was pretty much the limit for the church. It enjoyed enormous influence over the Western world for many, many centuries. Christianity became the preeminent world religion, and the church had a huge influence over the way people lived, thought, and acted. That is, until relatively recently. In more recent times, that influence has been waning, even plummeting, at least in the Western world. The Australian National Church Life Survey says that in 2011, estimated weekly church attendance accounted for less than 6% of the population. It's a 13% decline since 1991. In 2016, only 24% of Australians said that they believe in a personal God. And fewer than 20% of people attend church at least once a month. Between 1991 and 2011, the number of churches fell by more than 8%. I'd argue that purely through attrition, we now find ourselves here in Australia in a situation somewhat similar to the early church. As I said earlier, small and pretty much devoid of influence. Why would we expect to be heard? Or if heard, be taken seriously? When we add to that attrition the recent impact of the appalling findings from the Royal Commission into institutional responses to child sexual abuse, it seems to me that in the public eye, at least, the church has well and truly lost any right it may ever have had to take the moral high ground on issues of public policy. But that's not fair, I hear you cry. That was other people and other denominations. We can't all be tarred with the same brush. But again, I say that the world at large doesn't make that distinction. Try telling the average man in the street that your church is different. And you've got a blank stare. I've met many people who seriously don't know that there is any church other than the Roman Catholic Church. And yes, things may well have improved, even in the institutions where the abuse occurred. But the betrayal was enormous, and memories are long. For the church to judge others on the basis of their sexual orientation, or indeed on any perceived issue of morality, must seem to many like the height of hypocrisy. Again, I'm not here to discuss the biblical view of same-sex marriage or a biblical approach to LGBTI issues. Far cleverer people than me have preached sermons and written articles and academic papers on that subject. Anything I say will only be an opinion, as is everything I'm saying. I do find it a little amusing, though, that this issue seems to be of such enormous interest to conservatives in the church. This interest in what other people do behind closed doors seems a little out of proportion. For example, where are the open letters from prominent church leaders condemning practices uncovered in the Royal Commission? I know we're all appalled by it. What's being said publicly about that? For example, as I speak, the greatest humanitarian crisis since 1945 is unfolding in East Africa. 20 million people, men, women and children, are in imminent danger of starving to death. The UN has urgently called for $5.8 billion to prevent a catastrophe, but as yet only a fraction of that has been received. This is at a time when Australian overseas aid is at its lowest level in 8 years, and further real reductions were announced in the recent budget. Where are the open letters from prominent church leaders lambasting the government and calling for a more humanitarian Australia? For example, God's precious creation, this earth and its people, many of them with no power to influence the outcomes, are in serious peril from the ravages of man-made climate change. The scientific evidence for man-made climate change is overwhelming. Yet the world's second largest producer of greenhouse gases has just pulled out of the Paris Accords, while our own federal government seems to be hailing coal as the next green fuel. And our friends in Queensland are hell-bent on opening a brand new, enormous, shiny new coal mine. Where are the open letters from prominent church leaders on this? And to be fair, maybe the letters have been written, but maybe they haven't been given the publicity. Our press does hold a lot of power. But as an outsider, you could be forgiven for thinking that God's people care a whole lot about what goes on in certain people's bedrooms, and not too much about the fact that this world is in serious crisis in many other, dare I say, more important ways. But I digress. And of course, even if those letters are being written, or were to be written, by my own thesis, due to the waning influence of the church, I couldn't expect them to have much of an impact, could I? Well, maybe not, but they're worth writing anyway. And not just by church leaders, but by us, you and me, both as Christians and Australian citizens, rightly concerned for the welfare of our world and our fellow man. And that's a sort of a segue, not a very good one, back to where I was previously. Today's church, in my view at least, is a bit like the early church. Small, and pretty much devoid of influence. But I'm not sure we've realised that yet. See, our public image is that we're collectively a bunch of judgmental wowsers. And our public pronouncements seem to do little to disabuse people of that view. Yet we still keep making those pronouncements, or at least our outspoken, often self-appointed, spokespeople do, apparently assuming that they'll carry some weight, maybe even turn people from their errant path, when in fact they're most likely going to serve to further alienate us from the people we're trying to reach. So what can we do in this situation if we're small and lacking influence? I mean, we haven't been let off the hook, have we? We still have the Great Commission. We're still called to make disciples. We're still called to be the light of the world. Well, if we're becoming like the early church, why not take a leaf out of their book? After all, they went from being small and without influence to becoming the preeminent world religion. They must have been doing something right. So how did this small movement grow exponentially to ultimately change the world? Well, I'd argue that they didn't do it by being a group of judgmental wowsers. That came a little later. I'd argue that they did it by doing exactly what Jesus told them to do. They loved. In Matthew 22, from verse 36, we read, "Teacher, which commandment in the law is the greatest? Jesus said to him, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. The second is like it. Love your neighbour as yourself. And all the law and the prophets depend on these two commandments. The early church loved. They loved God with all their heart, soul and mind. They loved their neighbours, not just in their heads, but in practical ways. They sold property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. We're told that during devastating plagues, they put themselves in harm's way to minister to the sick. They looked after widows and orphans, the sick and the elderly. They loved radically. And the Lord added to their number daily. Several years ago, I went to the US, to Philadelphia, with my boss at the time, a somewhat conservative but huge-hearted Baptist. It seemed that in Philadelphia, on every street corner, there was a beggar. And Alan would go out each day with a pocket full of coins. Every single beggar that we passed had some change thrown into his or her hat or bowl. No questions, no judgment, just generous contribution. Alan loved without judgment. He knew he was blessed. He knew he was loved. He gave of himself and his resources easily out of that fullness. We all need to be more like Alan, I think. But I know I still haven't made it. Imagine how it would look if all of God's people, you and I, loved radically. How would it be if our default position in each and every situation was to love in practical ways, not just in our heads? In small ways, like stopping on the freeway to help someone who's broken down, which to my regret I didn't do the other day because I had a deadline to meet. Like throwing a coin into a beggar's bowl. Like giving a few hours of time to answer the call and help out in a renovation rescue. Like inviting a lonely neighbour over for a meal or going across the road to mow her lawn. And in bigger ways, like giving sacrificially to ease suffering in impoverished countries. Like giving substantially of our time to charities and social service organisations. Like setting a real example for others in the way we care for our world and our fellow man. What if God's people became known for their radical love? What if every local church became known for its radical love? What if this church became known throughout this region for our radical love? At the very least, we'd come some way towards meeting the great commandment to love our neighbours as ourselves. But I suspect that something far more profound would happen. In my reading for this message, I read an article online in a magazine called Relevant. The article had the no-nonsense title, Christians Shouldn't Be Culture's Morality Police. And in part, the article said this. If I were to take a bird's eye view of the country, if we were to take a bird's eye view of the country, we might find that as a whole, Christians are not known for their love. So it's safe to assume that as a whole, Christians are not known for showing Jesus to the world. What if we painted a new picture? What if Christianity was truly known for radical love and passionate pursuit of justice? Perhaps our lives would serve as a powerful invitation to come and see, like Peter leaving his boat. Love, radical love, is attractive. It's compelling. It points towards something the world lacks, but doesn't realise that it lacks. It points towards Jesus. To my knowledge, we were never called to demand that secular culture reflect biblical principles. We were never called to be the world's conscience or its judges. Rather, we were called to be examples. to point towards God's redemptive story, to show Jesus to the world. And Jesus, God, after all, is love.